And now, I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, John S. from Santa Barbara.
Good evening. My name is John. I am an alcoholic. The reason I had to put this up here is because someone told me someone would get my watch if I wasn't paying attention and it's gone. So I'll look for him after the meeting. I'm kidding. Thanks to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and a caring, loving higher power with a great sense of humor, I have been clean and sober since June 25th, 1985, one day at a time. And I know that is important to me because without the program of AA, I literally am not standing here. I like to thank the Southern California Speakers Group, Terry, and everyone that made it possible for me to come down here and share. I saw one of my friends, Connie, and a couple that I met that was in Santa Barbara visiting and going to a meeting. And what a small world. They said that they're going to be here, and here I am. Here they are. Good to see you. Thank you. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was raised in an alcoholic family. I really never paid any attention to it because, you know, they owned a construction business and was a school nurse. I never did without anything. And I really thought that's how families were. They would go out, they'd work all week, they'd drink when they got done, and that was just the way it was. I didn't see myself any different than anybody else. But my dad, when he got to drinking whiskey, became kind of a mean drunk. And as I growed up, I ended up being the funnel of his attention. I had a gift. I could get under my dad's skin in a second. It was a gift. And when I did that, and him being a construction worker, and he owned his business till he got tired of running it and just worked for someone. Construction back in the 60s, they had a couple things they did all the time. One, they had beer in the back of their truck in a cooler. And they put the fifth of booze up underneath the seat of the truck, and they kept their stash money somewhere in the truck for bail. I knew that. And, you know, and I knew where all of it was. But, you know, I tried the beer because in a construction, they want you to try to drink, and I tried, and I just never cared for the taste. And I saw what it did to him, and when I did irritate him, I got beat. And when he got drunk, he'd want to either beat up my mom, my little brother, or me. So considering I had the gift, I just made myself the focus of it. I didn't see a problem in that. You know, I thought that's just the way families were. I know somewhere in their heart they both love me, but when they were in the disease, and I didn't know they were in the disease, all I know was they would get into trouble every once in a while. They'd have to go to court. And in Santa Barbara, they were really kind. I mean, they didn't do anything to them. There was no consequence of action. They knew these people. They knew my parents, so they never made them punish or do anything to them. They'd make them go to a program. They'd come back, take a big book, throw it in the corner. And they weren't going to jail or getting in trouble. I had a stack of big books in the corner about 8 to 12 high from them doing that. And I had to go to adult children of, you know, alcoholics, and I'm being punished for their drinking. And I'd walk in the front door, say, I'm here. Oh, you have to get something signed. I'm not getting nothing signed. Get the hell out of my way, and out the back door I go. And I didn't think it was a problem. That was my life. And so in 1970, I graduated high school in 1971. For the first time in my life, I won a lottery. My number came up 6. And, you know, that wasn't a good number. And they take you down, you know, and you take all the tests. And I took the test, and school always came easy. So I did really good on the test, so good they thought I cheated. I said, you know, why in the world would I cheat on this test? And basically, due to my score, all the services called me. And I was able to pick whichever one I wanted. And I chose Coast Guard because, hey, you know, yeah. And, you know, so what I did is, you know, they offered me any position that I wanted if I was number 1 through 3 in my boot camp. And I was just, you know, I was a junior college All-American water polo. I was an all-school. I was an All-American kid growing up. And so I excelled. I loved competition. And I loved adrenaline. And in the service, I found a couple things. Drinking. Oh, I found drinking. They had clubs there that you could get booze for a quarter a shot. And you want to endear yourself to a first class or chief petty officer, sit there and go elbow to elbow with them and be the designated driver, and that would be the last one standing who could drive to take them home so they didn't get killed by their wife. So I inherited the gift of drink, too. So, and then I also found out adrenaline, because eventually I got off the icebreaker and ended up in Air Sea Rescue Station in New Orleans. And I flew along a lot of SAR search and rescues in really bad weather with two ex-NOM pilots, and the adrenaline was going crazy. I don't know. Adrenaline and booze just didn't mix well with me. And we would drink. We'd get called out. Adrenaline would kick in. We'd go do our rescue, come back, drink, go out. And I changed. I didn't see it, but there was something about the alcohol, the adrenaline, and other things that I found in the service due to competition. I found out that I was really good at supply and demand, you know? And people wanted stuff, and I had friends who had it, and they paid me money for it. So I'd introduce to people, get money from both sides. I didn't think that was a problem. When I was in the service, they couldn't even touch me. I was under the Department of Transportation, but at one time the Coast Guard was under the Department of Justice. I had a little badge and everything. Hey, you know, so it seemed like it was a needed. You know, I'm rationalizing, justifying that. I wasn't hurting anybody. I wasn't forcing nobody to do nothing. They were coming to me asking for it on both sides, and I thought it was a very good way to earn a little cash on the side. Well, I got out of the service, and in 1979, in my disease, a man pulled a knife on me, and I killed him. I was living in Santa Barbara at the time, and I'd never been arrested. I never got a speeding ticket, never got in any kind of trouble in my entire life. I knew nothing about jail, knew nothing about prison, knew nothing about ever being... Anytime I did anything, there was no, you know... I got away with it. I mean, there were never any consequences. My parents never paid any consequences. I never paid any consequences. On this one, I knew I was going to pay a consequence, because you just can't take a man's life if he pulls a knife on you or not. You just can't kill him. And so I ended up getting arrested. I actually turned myself in. They put me in county jail. So I'm put in county jail. I don't know anything about jail. But what I did find out, there's a lot of dysfunctional people in there that have a high that had a high opinion of themselves, that like to compete, that needed things. So supply and demand as well. I mean, I'm good at it. People trust me. And I look like Opie, but I fought like a Tasmanian devil. And it was really bad on your prison or jail rep to get beat up by Opie. So, you know, they left me alone. You know, so needless to say, I did not know I had a problem. I mean, I was drinking all the time. I wasn't working. I was earning a lot of money. I was traveling. You know, I was polluting everyone in my life. My family and friends who I've known my whole life, when they saw, I actually saw fear in their eye, and I did not care. It was who I was. You know, my whole world evolved around me, and I had a whole little group of people that would come to me for anything that I had and would give me anything to get it. So I really thought I was the center of the universe. And thank God that wasn't the case, because the universe would have been a really bad situation. But needless to say, I got found guilty of second-degree murder. So I go from county jail, which wasn't that bad, except I went from about 195 pounds to 140 pounds, because I just didn't get along well with people. I didn't play well with people. So they put me away and kept me pretty much to myself once they realized that. And they didn't feed me much. And I did like to eat, but when you don't get to eat, you lose weight. So by the time I got to prison, I was like 145 pounds, really looking like Opie. And I show up there, and I go, wow, guidance center wasn't too bad. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot going on, but then they go, oh, you got a choice, because, you know, what you did, you can go either Folsom or Quentin. I'm like, oh, okay, I'll pick Folsom. I got family in Sacramento. Good choice. I'm going to Quentin. I didn't know the game. You pick one, you're going to the other one. So I, who knew? I didn't. So I'm pulling up in front of San Quentin in the Great Goose, this big gray bus, chained hand and foot. I'm looking, and they stop outside this place. I'm going, wow, this place really feels evil. I mean, there's just a really negative energy that comes from that place. And I could feel it. I mean, you could feel it, like adrenaline coming up your back. You can feel it going, oh, this may not be as much fun as I thought. So they take you and they put you on fish row. And I'm looking around, and here comes people running in front of up and down the chair going, alcohol. Other things. And I'm going, what the heck's that? I asked myself, like, oh, no, that's how they do stuff. They got everything here. Supply and demand. Hey, I'm right back in. I'm going, cool. a bigger bang, a little bit more dangerous, more dysfunctional, a little bit more risky. But again, I love competition and I excel in competition. It was really bad for the prison rep to get beat up by Opie, and it happened to more than a few people till they realized I may look like that, but it's best to leave me alone because I wasn't quite right in the head. And it was just the way it was. And I did not think I had a problem. And then I found a staff member that would bring me a fifth of booze. I give him money, he give me fifth of booze. Then I realized, wow, at that price, if I get him to bring me two, I could sell the one for the price I paid for the two, and I could drink every day. Hey, I'm fine. I have alcohol of my choice, anything else that I wanted, because there was always someone that needed something. And for some reason, a lot of different people didn't get along, but they would trust me. So I could talk to this guy and this guy. They hated each other, but they would trust me enough so I could get the stuff or whatever. And, you know, it was a living, you know, and it was adrenaline. It was fun. And I'm sitting there thinking, God, you know, I want to go home. I really don't want to be in prison for the rest of my life. And I had no clue I had a problem. Finally, I went to an older guy and I said, do you think I have a problem? And he goes, John, you know what? You're drinking store-bought booze every day brought in by a guard. You're into everything, and people think you're crazy. Duh. Never occurred to me. Well, you know, what do I do? And he goes, well, look around. There's some people you can talk to. And what I did is I went to people, because this was about 2 years I did this, and I saw people, something had changed in some of these folks. And I go to them, I go, hey, I know you. You used to be as miserable as me, and I'm going to tell you, every little bump became a mountain in my life if I chose to let it be that. And I chose to let it be that. And I go to them, you changed. You used to be just like me. What happened? Well, I found AA, going to meetings, got a sponsor, working. Wrong answer. Both my parents died of alcoholism, and that is not the answer. I'm sure of that. I have a resentment against AA, so I go to another person. Same answer. Okay. I'm desperate. I really, really am desperate, and I'm willing. I go, damn, could that be the answer? My folks just didn't figure it out? Okay, so I go to a couple meetings at San Quentin. Didn't like them. Got me out of cell so I could keep my contacts alive. And never stuck. I end up going to another prison because they needed to just clear out some people, and I look like, still, I'm looking like Opie, so they put me because they look. I looked harmless, and I could play the game. As an alcoholic, I know what to say and how to act to get what I want. It's a gift. I've always had it, and I used it to my benefit. It's one of my defensive characters that paid really good dividends. And I ended up at CMC through a fluke. And when I got there, they did not want me there. They caught it pretty quick, and they say, what are you doing here? How did you get here? Hey, let Opie out. I don't know what to tell you. You should let me stay here, though, because I'm really good at getting things done. I'm a great clerk, and I want to change. And at that time, I really did want to change, because about that time, I had met my wife and my stepson, and one of them asked me a question. I don't know how many of you have kids, but they always ask you the question you do not have the answer. And their question was, Dad, why did you do what you did? Not what, not how, why. That's a really good question, and I did not have an answer. You know, and I knew one thing. I did not want to be my father to my son. My dad told me, don't drink, don't fight, don't get into trouble. And like 3 in the morning when I'm 14, he calls the house and goes, John, I know you know where my stash money is. I just got in a bar fight for drunk and disorderly. I'm down at county jail. You've got to get me out. Dad, it's only your truck out here. I know you can drive it. You stole it before, so I'm driving a truck. You know, 14-year-old driving his truck down with his stash money to bail him out. You know, this is not little mixed messages here. And I did not want to do that with my kids. I really love my kids, and, you know, and it was important to me to find the answer. And then the program has taught me, if you go looking for the answer, the teacher is there. So what I did, one of the people that I asked that had changed, his name was Gary Brown. He's no longer with us. He was the leader of the Vago motorcycle gang. He was the one that Cher with the kid when it was Sam Elliott, I think, played the guy. That was actually Gary that the story was about. And when I met him, we got along. I mean, we were in different worlds. And I asked him to sponsor me simply because I couldn't like threaten him. I mean, this was like a big dude. You know, and you know, so we became really good friends, and he worked me through the steps. Actually, we went through the steps, 1, 2, 3. And by the time I got through the steps, I actually had the why. And I can't tell you how important that was, because when I got to CMC, they have the Big Four Fellowship. And for those, the lady that does H&I, God bless you, they used to bring meetings in. And when the meetings would come in, the first time when I started going to them, because I really did want to change, but I still got these doubts. I mean, I see these people come in dressed all nice, suit, tie, all cleaned up. They cannot possibly know what's inside my head. And I'm sitting in the really rear of the thing. I got my Ray-Bans on, my glass head, you know, my hat pulled over my head. And if I could fall asleep, I would, but I snore. And people would come up, and one of them, his name was Curtis. And I can use the full name, because if I didn't, I'd get scolded. He's one of my gifts. And he used to come in there, and I'd sit in the back, and I'd go, God, look at this dude. What's this all black? He's like 65 years old. And he'd go, real deep voice. He'd go, my name's Curtis, and thanks to the program of AA. Kind of like how I said, I got 6,100,000 days, one day at a time. Because he went to the sobriety calendar, for those of you who have never been there, and he knew exactly to the day how many days he had. And I go, oh, my God, this guy's going to kill me. And I closed my eyes. And he started sharing, and I'm kind of like, ah. And then he goes, you know, I asked my sponsor one day when I really had a really, really good idea, and I told him what that idea was, and he said, Curtis, when you have a really good idea, you need to get a second opinion. And my eyes opened up, and it was like one of those things that I've heard in the meetings, and I've heard many of them since, that just rang true to me. I just knew that was the truth. For me, that was the truth. And I go, wow, he is me. Don't look like me. And that kind of appeals to me, because I was a little bit, I was working on myself. And I said, wow, maybe I just need to close my eyes and listen to these folks so I don't judge them. Because one of my defects of character I find out was, I know more about you than you do before you ever open your mouth. You know, and I didn't know nothing, but you know, it was my nature to want to do that. So what I did is I just quit judging with this. And I started listening with this, and I kept this shut. And it worked really good. And what I did is I heard messages of hope and heard the things I needed to hear in these rooms that moved me up. I went from the back row. Eventually, I became involved as a secretary, the chairman. You know, and AA and the people who were coming in became my friends. I'd sit right up front with them. I'd talk to them. They'd tell me, John, when you get out, come see us. I'm a lifer. I mean, Davis and Wilson are telling me I'm going to die in prison. In 1991, I got a date under Duke Mazian. And 1994, I thought I was going home. About a week prior to that, I think it was Wilson was in. I get a call in, we're taking your date. My wife and kids were out front. I go, wow, that sucks. You have to go to a hearing, though, before we can do it. Well, I've done a lot of hearings, so yeah, let's go to a hearing. So I go to a hearing, and they have Huey, Louie, and Dewey sitting at a table. And it's one of those, like, I'm, like, a lot bigger than they are, but when we sit down, it's like they cut the legs off my chair. I mean, they're up here and I'm down here, but when I stand up, it's the other way. I don't know how that worked, but it was a little uncomfortable. And they're going over my record, you know, all the things I've done inside, the psych reports, the job history, and everyone who's in my corner now. And they're going, wow, you know, I can see why you got your date. But I know Mr. McKinley's going to have something to say. This is the assistant DA that tried my case. And when I first met Mr. McKinley, this is my first words to me. Mr. Schluter, if you tell me that you killed this man and why, I won't gas you. And I'm chained hand and foot in an orange jumpsuit, and I leaped at this dude because I just dawned on me he threatened to kill me. And the only thing that stopped me from getting him, because I was going to headbutt him and bite him, was my ankles got caught on the corner of the desk. I went down on that table and got beat up by the bailiff. So, you know, we weren't friends. And what happened was I took a shot at him when I got to CMC, because I was not supposed to be there. And they had cameras, and they had all these different games you could play with balls, and one of them was tennis. I said, you know what, I had an idea. And again, I did not get to take Curtis' advice and get a second opinion. And I took a picture of me in tennis gear, and I sent it to him. Yeah. Wish you were here. Seemed like a great idea. But he knew it was a shot. you know, because he's a highly intelligent person, and we are a lot more alike than I like to admit. And so what he did is he started going to everybody that wrote letters on my behalf, people in the AA, people in the church, people that I was writing articles for, everyone. And he's going to everybody, go to the door and go, do you know who this man is? Yeah, we do know who he is. And so he would start describing who I was, and they would say, that's not who he is, that's who he was. He'd go, that's the wrong answer, and he'd go to another one, just like I did. And he'd go to another one and another one. So, you know, he got to know me very, very well. So when they asked him, do you think, you know, he should go home? He goes, you have no idea the history I have with this man. I'll tell you this. I think he's done too much time. You should let him go. And Huey, Louie, and Dewey did not want to hear that one, because this guy's not a liberal. He never said that about anybody. So they told me to leave. I come back. They took my date anyway, because it was one of those Wilson Davis things. Said, we were all going to die in prison. They were going to make sure of it. And it hurt. Trust me, it hurt, because I really did think I was going home, because I am special and unique, and I got it under domination, and why would you want to do that to me? But, you know, it has never been about me, you know, and the program has started to make that real to me. So I started smiling. And, you know, McKinley looks at me and goes, why are you smiling? They just told you that you can't go home. I go, and I know, and I don't even want to share this with you, Louie, and do it, but there's a lesson here. There's always a positive lesson in every negative experience. This one came to me like that. So it was one of those God things, because I'm not that sharp. So he goes, would you like to share it? I'd love to share it, but I'm not sharing it in front of these three people. They made this decision based on politics, not on the record. You want to know, come see me. So he follows me out, shakes my hand. Remember, this is the man I tried to bite. And he goes, what's the lesson, John? I'm going, my number one critic in life just put on the record that due to my actions, you support me to go home. So I'm doing the right thing, and eventually politics will be left out of the program, and I will go home. So I'm here for a reason. Now I got to figure out what it was. So I went to a friend of mine, Tim W., who manages Santa Barbara Central Office. He comes in on H&I and I go, Tim, what do you think? There's something you're supposed to be doing. Go find it. Okay. And what they did is they had 4 yards where I was at, and one of them had mentally ill on it, the mental illness, EOP, triple C. And they are not allowed to go to the AA meetings at the Big Four with us. And I said, I know, because again, it came to me too fast. I said, I know what I need to do. So I moved to that yard, and I started meetings 3 times a day, 7 days a week. I got permission. It started by me going to the middle of the yard with a big book, and you build it, they will come. Started with like 5, then 10, then 40. If you have more than 6, you're grouping. And I got called to the office, and they said, what's going on here? What's happening? I said, well, I'm doing AA meeting. You can't do that. Too many people. Okay. What's the solution? We'll give you a room. All right. I like that solution. So they gave me a room. They opened up this little classroom, and we had meetings there 3 times a day, 7 days a week. And we worked step studies. We did everything I needed to do. Actually, I was doing H&I from the inside. And I was getting stuff sent from the central offices, chips, everything. And it just helped me. It just, I can't tell you how rewarding it is to be a servant. That is the one thing I know in my heart that kept me sober and kept my hope up through all of this, because I knew eventually I would be out. The when never had anything to do with it, because I have no control over when. Well, needless to say, in 2004, I got a date again. And it was another one of those God things, because I was scheduled to do parole in Idaho. I had all my job plans, and I called my wife about 2 weeks prior to my hearing. And she goes, John, I got some great news. It's got to be about me. So I go, tell me more about me. And she goes, oh, no, it's not about you. I'm coming to California, to San Diego. I got a great job. Are you crazy? My hearing's in 2 weeks. You're going to... And I know I just killed her on the phone. And you don't get very long phone calls. And as soon as I hung up, I heard in my head, 10, 11, 12, 10, 11, 12, 10, 11. Okay, go back, pray, meditate. I went to an officer in the morning, because I get up early for early release and go out and get everything set up at my job. And I asked an officer, can I have like 5 minutes on the phone? I think I killed my wife and I have to clean this up. Okay, so I get on the phone and I tell her, hey, it's never been about me. God will provide. Go to your job. We'll see what happens. So when I went up to the hearing, all my job plans were for Idaho. Now my wife's moving to San Diego. So that's not going to work. So when I go up there, I have no letters or anything that was sent to me. When I walk in here, I have an attorney about yay tall. 90 pounds, smiling at me, and I wasn't in a lot of mood for smiling. What are you smiling at? I got two letters. I'm going, cool. And he goes, read them. So I read them. First was like from the probation officer, and went to everyone involved in the case, and everyone in the case told him that I had changed, they support my release. A couple of them offered me a place to stay. Another one offered me a job in Santa Barbara. And I hadn't talked to any of these people since I got arrested because I didn't want them to have to do time with me. The second one was from the Mr. McKinley and Mr. Sneddon, the DA. They told him they're not participating in this farce anymore. He's done too much time, and he should have been released 10 years ago. I wasn't expecting either one of these letters. Who would? So they go, you want to do your hearing? Yeah, I go to the hearing. They give me a date. I'll never forget that, because when I went in and they go, Mr. Schluter, we don't find you unsuitable. Double negative, basic English, you know, because it took a minute for me to figure that out. It isn't say, hey, you can go home. They have to put a little twist to it. And I start crying. I don't care, you know, whatever you want to say. When you have the hope of going home, it just, you know, and at that time, Arnie was in the office and people were actually going home. You know, he was actually judging people case by case, and he said, I had done too much time and I should be home. Okay, so now I get out of prison after 26 years. 26 years in prison, and I think I'm going to Santa Barbara. I get in the car of my parole officer because they have to come and take me because I'm high risk. First life for getting released into this area. He's freaking out. I don't know what to expect. I'm on that side of the wall. I kind of like that. I'm free. And I don't know what the heck to expect. And then on the way, he goes, I got good news and bad news. Okay. Give me the good news. I don't want no bad news. Give me a break. 26 years of business. I didn't want to hear nothing bad. He goes, there is no good news. Well, this isn't much fun of a game. Give me the news. Well, you can't go to Santa Barbara. We have concerns. Arnie didn't have no concerns, but you have concerns. Okay. Where am I going to go? So they dropped me off in Santa Maria. And I don't know anybody in Santa Maria. I mean, I don't. And I go, where am I going to stay in Santa Maria? Well, you got $200 gate money. I'm going, that's going a long way. But basically, it was their mistake, so they put me into a motel indeterminately called the Western. Not the Best Western, but the Western. And it had a key to the door, you know, little side keys. Never saw one of them before. It had a refrigerator. It had a TV. It had a bed. And HBO. So that's cool. I mean, put me anywhere. I mean, who knew? And they said, bad news, it could have been anything. And he's going, you're taking this well. I'm going, okay. And then they start telling me all the things that would never happen. After 26 years in prison, you'll be lucky to get a job in 2 years. You have no job history, no work history, no credit history, all the no's, you're never going to happen. And I'm going, wow, you're kind of negative. And again, but the program had taught me something. It taught me that everyone's entitled to an opinion. And everyone wants to have an opinion on everyone else's expense. It only becomes a reality if I accept it. And the program told me the one who is responsible for my actions and consequences is me. No one else. When I found out why I did what I did, when I checked it all back, I was always the first step in the problem in my life. No one else was ever responsible for anything that happened in my life. Never. I was always the one that was responsible for everything that ever happened to me. Even though for a long time you couldn't have convinced me and I would have went to hell to fight you for it. But I know that. So I tell them, well, it's nice you have that opinion, but I'll tell you what I know. I have computer skills. I got organization skills. I got people skills. I've taught life skills. I've got all these things going for me, and I will find someone out there willing to give me a chance. Because the program of AA always told me when those H&I people would come up, when you get out, call me. We'll be there for you. So I dropped off in Santa Maria. My first phone call is to a friend of mine, Tim W. He manages Santa Barbara AA. I'm in Santa Maria. They're expecting me in Santa Barbara. They know I'm getting out. And they're having a little get-together, thinking they're going to have a little get-together. And I get on the phone, and I dial the 800 number, put 50 cents in the phone book, dial the 800 number. Tim, I got good news and bad news. I don't want to play no games. Where are you at? Well, you're no fun. I'm out, but I can't come to Santa Barbara. Okay, where you at? Tell me where you're at. My property's at my friend's house, who I thought I was going to stay. My money's there. I'm in the Western Motel. Oh, okay. So he goes and gets everyone. AA comes together, gets all my stuff. He comes up, shows up at the motel. We're going to a meeting. Cool. Take me to a men's stag in the Rio Grande. 26 years in prison, that would not have been my first choice. My wife, but not mine. So basically what happened, I went there and they knew I was coming because they, you know, the grapevine and it's real. And the secretary let me share a little bit long, and then after the meeting, everyone came up and gave me cards and shook my hand, and the secretary came up and he goes, "Do you know who I am?" I'm going, "Yeah, you're Armando, the secretary." He goes, "You know what I am? Yeah, my radar is going off. You're a police officer of some sort." And he goes, "Yes." And he gave me a handshake and a hug, and he welcomed me, and I'm still in touch with him. I work with him. He's retired. You know, so there's one thing that was shattered. One of those never happened. And then I found a job. Someone gave me a chance to work installing computer and phone systems. And then I ended up being the manager of that job for over a year. And then he thought the job was going down. He thought he was going to go out of business. He said, "You need to find another job." I said, "Okay. What you going to do?" "Okay, I'm sitting there waiting. I get a phone call from Tim W., first person I called. "John, I'm thinking about retiring. Would you like to go to work in Santa Barbara Central Office?" "Okay." I'm living in Lompoc. I have no money in the bank, and he wants me to move down to Carpinteria. And by this time, I have enough credit that I can do that. There's no credit history. I was able to buy a brand new PT Cruiser. I don't know why they did it. I think they thought I had money. When they typed my name into this little computer thing and checked my credit history, I had no credit history. And then they asked me why. I said, "I can honestly say I have not bought anything on credit for over 26 years." But they gave me the PT. You know, it's my wife's dream car, so, you know, and I drove, you know, and another thing they said couldn't happen. And then I moved down to Carpinteria, which is by Santa Barbara, and I started about a year ago working part-time there. I worked two jobs. And Tim decided to retire, and I was hired as a full-time manager of Santa Barbara Central Office. And, you know, and that's not a me thing. This is one of them God things, because I could not ever have planned any of these things happening. The first number I called upon getting out was the H&I, was AA Central Office. Now I'm answering that same phone. That's not a me thing. I wish I could take credit for that, but the old me was like, I'm not that slick. I'm just not. But I'm grateful every day when I go into that. Every day when I get up, I look forward to going to work, and every day I leave that job, I'm thankful I was there. I mean, it's just one of those things I can't explain. And it's just another one of those things that people said, this is never going to happen. And then I get a phone call, and this is another one of those things. I graduated from CMC. 26 years, they let me go. They told me, you'll never get back into there. But 4 months ago, I got a phone call saying, hey, we're having a celebration for another program that I helped start. A lot of people in AA were involved. It was Alternatives to Violence. And would you like to come back in here and talk to everybody? Okay. And it's like one of those things, sure, you say, okay, but you know it's never going to happen. So I feel pretty, next thing I know, they're sending me the paperwork, I'm filling it out. Next thing you know, they're calling, show up. So I show up in front of the prison in my little car, in my suit. I was dressed just like this. I go, wow, never thought this was going to happen. Took a deep breath, walked right on in. They said, sir, can we help you? Yeah, sir. I go, yes, you can. I'm here for this celebration. And the other people were there for it, and they knew I was coming. And all of a sudden, the officer's going, because there has to be a memo signed by a lot of people, including the governor. And he was still calling me sir, but it was kind of like, sir, watch this guy, you know. And they brought an escort to escort me into this thing, and I went in there and I talked to over 100 men about, you know, how miracles can happen in your life, how the program of AA and taking the tools that you use in this program can change your life. The newcomers, you never, and I know this for a fact, ever, unless you choose to. And there are some people that decide they need more research, you know, and I do know that happens, but you know what, that's okay. The book says a third gets it right away, a third takes a little bit, and a third die. As long as you ain't in that third to die, you got a chance. And if you think it can't happen, I've been to a couple funerals recently that did happen. And I've seen people with 30 years or more relapse. And I asked them, what happened? too many years, not enough days. I'm going, wow, that's one of those things that rang real true. Because I understand what it is that I did for the first day when I came into this program to stay sober is what I need to do for the rest of my life. And I know when I first started, I said, I don't have time for all of this. There's just not enough time in the day to do these things. I hear that from my sponsees now. There's just not enough time in the day. And I sent them down and we figured out there's plenty of time. And I find I'm doing more now than I ever did with the exact same amount of time in a day. And I still have extra time for other stuff because it just seems to work out. You know, I don't have a lot of expectations. I just don't. I know that my higher power, who's up there, is barrel laughing about me. And he just puts you where you're supposed to be. He just puts me where I'm supposed to be, and then he gives me a chance to do something. I'm working with someone who told me, he's relieved my disease of alcohol. I don't have the desire to drink anymore. So what are you going to do now? I'm cured. Oh, no, no, no. Hell no. But this man was serious. He was serious. He thought that's all there was to it. I'm going, you know, I hate to break it to you, but this is just beginning. I mean, you know, as much as I'd like to just say that, you know, hey, I quit drinking and life got better, I'd have been relapsed. I know I would have. I know from my experience, and I know from this program also, I don't want opinions. I don't want advice. Never did. I don't take it worth a damn. Sorry, hard-headed, whatever. But what this program gave me when I walked in scared and not doing, they gave me people that shared their experience. And we talked to Jeff before then, said experience, strength, and hope. You walk in here and you share what's worked for me. And when I first came into the program, they would tell me this is what worked for me, and I'd watch them to see if it really did. Because, you know, there's a whole lot of people that lied to me when I was growing up. But I never found that in the program, the people that are really doing the deed. And you see them. They're the ones that every day, they just, they're, things are just a little bit happier in their life. You know, they look forward to the day where, you know, sometimes, you know, things aren't going good, but you know what? I'm okay because I'm sober today. That's all it is. I'm sober today. If I keep doing what I need to do, I'll be sober tomorrow. I get in service. I love the H&I people. I mean, trust me, you're in my heart. Because if it wasn't for you, I'm not standing here. And if you've never done it, you should go try it. And I don't care what your background is or anything, there's some way you can be in service. Because I am. I'm doing H&I. I'm going into places. Not places I thought I could go. Some places they'll let me go. Who knows? No one can stop you from doing anything. I was never stopped from getting anything in my life that I truly wanted to get. And I finally found why my parents failed in the program. Because they were doing the program for me, my brother, my grandmother, and everybody else but themselves. And I'm a selfish son of a gun. When I do something for myself, it's 110%. When I do something for someone else, I don't care how much I love them, maybe 80 or 85. And I'd die for my family. I would take a bullet for them in a second. But I ain't going to give you 110%. I'm sorry. I just can't. I mean, I wish I could. But I know me, and I can't. But in this program, when I wanted this program with the same enthusiasm I wanted my disease, I got it. And everyone in my life who I wanted to benefit and get those things that I wanted them to have got it as a byproduct of me working the steps and the promises coming alive in my life. I know that's true, because otherwise I wouldn't be standing here talking to you. I'm John. I am an alcoholic.